Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. I guess it's
Nice to chat with you.
a little late in the evening for you, huh?
It's 9 o'clock, yeah, but
Okay.
I do my work mostly in the evenings, so yeah.
Okay, good. So what we're doing is we've been working on a new podcast behind the scenes at Fizzle, and we want to highlight the stories of Fizzlers who have made it to that minimum viable income number that we always talk about. And this came out of hearing from our customers over and over that they love hearing about Pat Flynn or Amy Porterfield or whoever, are in our founder stories. But what they really want to hear are success stories from people who aren't so far ahead of them and who have come from the Fizzle community at some point. So the goal of this podcast is we'll do long form interviews and then we'll cut them back to more of kind of a narrative storytelling show. So we plan to do 60 to 90 minute interviews with each person eventually, and then we would cut that back to a 20 to 30 minute show that kind of captures what your business is and how you got to where you are. So the goal of this call is mostly just to get kind of you, if you think of your business journey, your personal and business journey as kind of a bullet point list of highlights or milestones, that's what I'd really like to get out of this call. So if you want to take me back kind of as far as you feel like is relevant to your business journey, even if that's personal stuff, and we can start there and then we'll figure it out.
So you do know my business a little bit, and you do know what it's about.
I do, but I want you to put it in your words so that when we talk about it in the terms you like.
Sure. So basically, I've been a freelance journalist for over almost 15 years now. And initially, I was working from India. So I started when I was a college student. And I was writing for mostly American publications. So I started as a college student in India as a freelancer and writing for American publications. And I did this for 15 years, but pretty much the moment I started writing is the moment I started blogging as well. And blogging at the time did not exist in the form that it exists now. So I basically had a website that I would hand code and, put updates on and put tips on. And that got a bit of a following over, a period of time. And I just shared my journey as a young female writer in India, and then I was traveling all over the world as well for my reporting, and I was doing this all independently. And this is about the time when freelancing as a career option was becoming something of a thing. This is the kind of time when millennials were going, we don't want to do corporate. And I wasn't really clued into the trend. I was just a millennial doing that. And I was doing it from a place where it's not traditionally, a lot of Americans doing it, a lot of, Brits doing it. There weren't that many Indians and Africans who were sort of freelancing, especially for foreign publications. And so I got a lot of traffic from Asia and Africa, and a lot of emails and questions from people in those places. And I had a huge US readership as well, global citizens, I suppose, who wanted to know about traveling in India, going to India, reporting in India. So it was kind of like a foreign correspondent community that kind of existing on my blog. And this it wasn't monetized. I didn't really do much with it. And then a couple of years ago, I started burning out on freelancing simply because I'd had a child. I couldn't travel as much as I wanted to, and fiction had always been my first love, and I wanted to make that transition. At the same time, I was answering so many questions. I would get hundreds of questions a week from people, and I just thought, I could. This is the time again when courses were beginning to be coming up and self-publishing, and so I thought, I'll do a course and for people who would like to learn how to pitch properly and get assignments. And I launched a course 2 years ago, and immediately I had 50 signups. And this was absolutely shocking to me because I hadn't expected that level of interest. I hadn't even thought of monetizing the website. And at that point, I think something clicked, and I thought, this could be, we're hearing all about this internet business and things. And that wasn't my primary goal. It still isn't. But again, it was something that I could use as a bridge to help me reach my own personal goals such as fiction and things that interest me in journalism. But also, again, like I said, there's so many people questioning how to do this, especially from Asia and Africa, mm-hmm. that I thought I could put out these resources. And I did. And now the greatest thing for me now is that through my courses, the students who've taken those courses have ended up, you know, people who had never been published anywhere have ended up being published in the New York Times, Time, you know, the Washington Post, all over the place, Nat Geo. And it's amazing. We formed a little community now through my e-courses. And yeah, it's just grown and grown. And so since then, I've launched about two more courses. One has been for content marketing, which is content marketing for journalists. So basically people who are content marketing, for people who are journalists, but who also want to write content for corporates and make more money that way.
Right.
And then there's one on if you're a writer. I mean, like, for instance, Fizzle is for people who are interested in online business. But I have a course that teaches not particularly online business, but how to monetize your writing in a business way. So it's called Make Money with Websites, but it is targeted specifically towards writers. And so those are the big three products at the moment. I've got a couple of ebooks. I've got an ebook coming out next week. And so basically that's been the journey so far. And yeah.
Excellent. So let's go back and fill in some of the gaps there.
Okay.
Just taking one more note. Okay, so you started your journalism career as a college student from India.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. What year was that that you started your journalism career?
2002. Okay. Actually, it might have been earlier. I can give you a year. I think it was, I think September 2002 probably.
Okay.
I mean, I was writing before that, but that was when it professionally started.
Right. Okay, and when you started doing that, you were writing for American media from India.
That's right. Yeah.
Based out of India.
I was based out of India for all those years. I now live in England. I moved here in 2014.
Okay. So, and at that same time as you were kind of kicking off your career, you started blogging before that was really even a concept. And you were hard coding your own website to update that regularly with what you were learning and kind of sharing tips from that.
Yeah, it was sort of like a website for writers. And actually at the time I had an email list, which was bigger than the email list I have now, which was about 7,000 people. And it was a really good email list. And actually in 2005, I self-published a book that sold, I don't know how many copies it sold, but I remember I made $10,000 in that first year. And then I took it off the market because I felt like that wasn't what I wanted to do. And so then I shut down that website and just kept blogging on my personal website starting 2006. So my audience kind of stayed with me. Some of them fell off, but I intentionally moved it from a business to a personal site because I wanted to focus more on my journalism at the time.
So that first site, what did you call that one?
writerscrossing.com. And it is now still a website, but somebody else took the domain. So somebody else is running a site, but it's not about writers now. It's their personal site.
Right.
And it's two guys, one called somebody something crossing and one called something writers. So
funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so you started an email list, you had the blog, and you wrote a book in 2005 as kind of part of that site. What was that book called?
It was called Knock Their Socks Off, The Freelance Writer's Guide to Writing Query Letters That Sell. And I'm about to relaunch that book actually in a couple of months. I can send you the titles and everything if you like over
that's
email.
Great. That's funny that you're going back to it now.
I think I never really stepped away from helping writers. I think I started doing that the moment I became one. It was just kind of sharing that journey. And the only difference has been I have questioned at various points in my career whether I wanted to put a focus on that in terms of money. Because when you make it a business decision, then you have to treat it like a business. And then you have to put your energy and time into it. And I feel like I am a business person in that sense, is that if I decide to treat something like a business, then I really do put the time and effort into it. And there was a certain point in my career, there was a 6 or 7 year period where I didn't want to spend that time and effort, and I wanted to put that time and effort into my own journalism. Mm-hmm. Because I was traveling a lot, I was, you know, visiting new countries, I was living out of a backpack, and I felt like I couldn't do it justice, and I couldn't do people justice if they expected something from me, and I was, you know, pretending to be a business then. I didn't think I could do it at that time. And I also felt like I needed to go out and get that credibility, because there's anybody can put up a website for writers, and people do. And I personally felt that I couldn't teach people how to be successful at freelancing unless I could myself have that credibility of, you know, the names and the publications and the regular work and the money and all of that. And I felt like for me, at least in my own head, it was important that I have that before I could teach others how to do it. Because, and I think that's the thing that makes me stand out at the moment as well. I am one of very few people who have a writing website who actually have the body of work to back it up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what sets me apart sometimes. And that's why people flock. I get a lot of emails from people saying, can you specifically tell me how to break into the New York Times? And I can. And so I think that kind of gives me confidence as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's really important. And that's a trend that we see with a lot of the success stories that come out of Fizzle. Are a lot of these people have spent many years building the expertise, and then we just give a little boost as far as business knowledge, and then they're off to the races because they did the hard work already.
Yeah, and I'm completely in favor of people, you know, like I did when I started, I was, you know, immediately sort of teaching people what I'd done one day before. You know, I'm completely for that business model. I just felt that also that what that thing was missing was that I couldn't see people, like what I wanted to do internationally and in terms of being an Indian who wanted to work for foreign media and who wanted to tell these stories, I didn't know where to look because the people who were doing it were not writing about it. And the people who were writing about it had not done it, at least in that same fashion. And so I wanted to provide that resource. I wanted to be that person who says, look, I've done it. Mm-hmm. And here's how you can do it too. And so I would post like conversations I'd had with my editors at Time and things like that on my personal blog. And now those have all become sort of parts of blog posts and courses and things like that. But I reused a lot of that material in the end. But I was sharing that journey as I went along because I felt like, you know, that's the information that's missing. Nobody really talks about how to get into these. It's such a mystery. We see so much, and especially with writing and arts, you see so much of the vague, just do it kind of thing.
Right.
And we don't really see the specifics of how easy it can be. I mean, if people come into my course, and it's a 30-day course, the one that teaches them how to get into magazines and things. And it's eye-opening for them because they go, oh, it's just a simple series of steps. It's not really that hard. The whole, oh my God, it's New York Times goes away. And suddenly it's just, oh, it's the New York Times. I sent them a pitch yesterday. And it's not a big deal anymore. And I think that really makes a difference for a whole writing career. And then they're off, you know?
Right. Okay, so in 2005, you launched that book and you made a decent amount of money with it. $10,000, you said.
Yeah.
Yep. Which kind of showed you, oh, wow, I could make money from this.
Yeah.
But you still had that internal struggle of, do I want to build a business around helping other writers? And so that was going on throughout this time.
I have and I still do, and I think maybe this is something to cover, is that I have always had, and I still have, a battle between the artist part of me and the business part of me, which is the artist just wants to go write the novel and just wants to go do the journalism and not have to talk about it. And the business part of me is like the one who wants to share everything, the one who wants to do monthly reports, and the one who, you know, I have two parts of me, and they're equally strong. But every now and again, one is stronger than the other. And so at the time, I think the artist part of me was taking over pretty massively. And I'd also had a crisis of confidence. And in one fell swoop, I basically deleted that 7,000 people email list. I think it's one of my biggest mistakes. And I still haven't got to 7,000 now with my current email list, but that's what I did. I basically deleted it, and I told people, if you want to stay on top of what I'm doing and everything, I've got a personal website and a blog. Some people did stay, but a lot of people, as you can imagine, didn't.
Wow. So when was that? Do you remember?
That was 2006. Yeah, that was 2006.
So you had kind of seen a little bit of success teaching writing, you know, you had built an audience there. There was this community of people interested in the work you were doing and in doing similar work. And then one day you just said, this is too much. The artist is getting the best of me. I don't want to do this anymore.
I just want to go create. I want to be, you know, I want to be a writer. I want to sit in my hole and write, and I want to travel, and I want to, all of those things that I just said before. You know, I want to be a journalist. I want to travel. I want to tell stories. And yeah, I was young as well. I was stupid. I think also I suspect now it has something to do with seeing a little bit of success and, you know, standing in your own way. I think a little bit sabotaging it when you start seeing success. I think a lot of people do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
And then you said that there was kind of a, having a child was a significant point in this journey. So when did that happen?
That was 2012, January 2012. By that time, I mean, before that, in 2010, I had won awards for my journalism. I'd won two big awards for my journalism. I'd been named the Development Journalist of the Year in one of the Asia's big awards. And a lot of that required me to, that was for a story I did on waste pickers in India, basically people who pick through trash for a living. So I was doing that kind of reporting. It was development journalism. It was that kind of reporting. It was traveling. It was hanging out in hospitals and, you know, landfills and that sort of stuff. And about the time I got pregnant in 2011, it just, you know, I just felt like, I think that the parent thing kicks in and you go, I can't put myself in dangerous positions, and I can't, and I didn't want to be away from my child once he was born. And so I had to find a way to do the thing that I loved without actually doing the thing that I loved, which made it really hard, because the thing that I love about journalism is going and seeing people and telling their stories. And I loved the traveling, and I loved the, you know, the hardcore part of it. And I think that was the thing that I had to take out. And that's when I started falling out of love with it, because that's the thing that attracted me to it. And then having a child at home, I just didn't want to. It's not even that I couldn't. I just didn't want to leave him behind while I was off in hospital. I didn't want to take him with me, and I didn't want to, like, to dangerous places, and I didn't want to leave him behind. And I think at that point is when I had always wanted to write books. I had always wanted to write novels and nonfiction as well. And at that point, I thought, okay, now I need to get serious about books again. And it's been, I mean, there were other parts of the journey, agents, this, that, the other, which is kind of probably not relevant here. But now I'm again, now, like, I'm just in the process of selling a book. And so, you know, it's that journey that I've come now. And again, now, the International Freelancer, yes, is based on freelancing and international freelancing in specific, but a lot of the people on there have questions about books and have questions about the writing life and the writing journey. And so I feel like I'm able to share all of these experiences that I'm now having as well. So it's kind of broadened almost. Like, I started off very specific, and then now it's kind of growing a little bit more into something different. So I'm quite excited about where it goes now as well.
Right. So in 2006 was when you kind of deleted everything and said, okay, I'm transitioning to my personal website. I just want it to be about my work and not so much pressure on there being a business here.
Yeah.
And then in 2010, you won a couple of big awards for your journalism during that time.
Yeah.
So between 2006 and 2010, was that kind of when you just put your head down and you were out there in the field doing the reporting, exploring, traveling?
Yeah, I lived in Africa. I lived in America for a year. I was in India. Yeah, that's when that is the point when I broke in all the big publications as well, the New York Times, Time. Some of my biggest successes journalistically happened during that time.
Okay.
I think because I had focus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, and then, so 2011, you got pregnant. You started having thoughts of, you know, I have another life to consider now. I can't just keep putting myself in these dangerous positions or seeking out the thrill of the journalism.
Yeah.
You know, obviously having your child really solidified that and not wanting to travel away from him. And at that time was when you noticed that you were getting a lot of questions about how to pitch assignments to these publications. And that was what led to the first course.
Yeah, I mean, I'd always had questions and I'd always answered them on the blog or through email. And then 2012 is when I relaunched my email list. And after my son was born, I thought, you know, I was reading so much. I'd taken a bit of a break. I was working part-time. I was reading a lot about email lists, and so I just started up an email list. And I think it was about 1,000 just when I started. And then in January 2014 is when I launched the first course. I hadn't written it. I hadn't done anything. I just had an idea. I put it out there, and 50 people signed up, and I went, oh, right now I have to actually create this thing.
Right. What was the name of that one?
30 Days, 30 Queries, and it's still our most popular one.
Okay.
So basically I teach them how to send 30 pitches to editors in 30 days.
Right, with the goal of getting one or more stories.
And a lot of them end up getting so busy that they never send 30. <That's> which is the idea, right?
And so out of that course was where you started to see some of those students be successful in pitching and publishing and Time and the New York Times,
yeah,
and National,
yeah,
Geographic and all that.
And they were all, like, we have a Facebook group, so they were all sharing, you know, their experiences, and they were all sharing their, you know, the contact information of editors and all. So it just, it became this thing bigger than I had imagined it to be. And, you know, I really liked the money when it came in. But once they started seeing this massive level of success, you know, for that, for a lot of them, you know, in the writing career, if you have, the New York Times doesn't pay much.
Right.
But what it pays for is, if you can say, I've written for the New York Times and Time, everybody else pays you a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So those credits make a huge difference in a writing career, because you carry them all through your career.
Right.
And
right.
So this kind of, you know, yeah, basically helped.
It gives them kind of a pedigree in the,
Yeah. Way. Yeah.
So then you went into kind of business mode, and you launched a couple more courses. So for that second course about content marketing for journalists, when did that come out?
That was April of last year. And that was actually, just to me, that was the biggest success that I'd ever seen at that point. I launched that course, and within 4 days, I'd made $10,000. And I had been very skeptical of launching that course because, you know, I mean, it's just, I suppose we're always skeptical of launching products, or at least I am. You don't know how they're going to do. And I knew there was interest, but I didn't realize there was that level of interest. And I had priced it at a point that I was not comfortable with, that I wasn't sure would work at all. So it was $397 for a text-based course. There's no video, no audio, just lessons. And yeah, people paid for it. People loved it.
That's great. And then go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and you launched the third course as well.
That was late last year. That was in November last year.
Okay. And how'd that one do?
That was okay. That didn't go as well as the others, but I think it did about $5,000 maybe, but not that big, you know, the number that I had with the content marketing one. And also I keep relaunching them as well. So I open cart, close cart.
Right.
So they don't always, and I think I'm probably experimenting with changing that model, but so far it's been like I open it up for people and then I close it up again so that I could work with that group of people on that particular month. Mm-hmm. And so you know, that the 30 Days, 30 Queries has been ongoing. There have been quite a few sessions of that. The Content Marketing for Journalists, there are quite a few sessions of that. So I keep, you know, on and off doing that.
So, and then it sounds like in the background, as you know, the business is running, it's successful, you know, you're not out traveling doing the journalism anymore, but you are working on fiction behind the scenes.
I am doing journalism as well. I'm just doing journalism that's kind of, you know, local, and that's not dangerous. It doesn't require a lot of travel. It doesn't require, so I am doing journalism. I'm kind of picking and choosing at the moment. I'm doing a lot of content marketing at the moment, which is very well paying work. Mm. So I probably don't want to mention my clients, but
because
you know, they happen through agencies, but I'm working with, like, you know, IBM and HKI, which is Helen Keller Foundation, and things like that. So, you know, I'm kind of, you know, they need journalists to do their content for their organizations. And so I've kind of, as a development journalist, you know, I had that specific skill set of knowing the developing world really well. So I've kind of worked with the Nigerian government, for instance, to create their website and things like that, which come out of the journalism but aren't journalism. And then, yes, of course, fiction, short stories, essays, all that stuff. Basically, if it requires writing, I'm there.
Right. And so we'll talk about more of that in the interview, but it sounds like a lot of your heart's in that fiction place right now.
My heart's in A lot of things, actually. I do really enjoy the journalism, but I got really tired of the way, you know, I mean, journalism has changed a little bit in the last few years. When I started out, journalism was a different beast to what it is today. And I'm not a fan of the way journalism is at the moment. Like, I don't want to, I mean, I'm not a fan of the list style of journalism. And I'm kind of really big on narrative. And I've always specialized in that sort of profiles and narratives. And there's not a lot of market for that. And the problem was that after my son was born as well, and I've always, my husband had quit his job at the time, and I had to support us. And this is not the kind of work that pays the bills. It's not the kind of work that pays anything, really.
Right.
And so my heart is in that work of telling stories, whether that's through fiction or through journalism or through whatever. I don't see myself as, like, you know, the kind of person who's ever going to be writing like 10 blog posts a day type thing for, you know, I mean, it's just, I'm not saying in any way that that is a bad thing. I that's just not where I find my joy.
No, absolutely.
And so I just made that conscious decision. So I do content marketing. With content marketing, I focus on organizations that I feel like I connect with. Like I mentioned Helen Keller, for instance. They do a lot of work on blindness and things, and then they need somebody to write about that, you know, the people who are in the field profiling that their work. And so I feel like that's kind of like a little bridge for me, that pays well and also kind of helps me keep connected to that world. I encourage writers, like, you should do whatever you feel called to do in the time that you feel called to do it. So today it's fiction, tomorrow it might be, you know, something else. And I've written books, how-to books for writers, and I feel equally proud of those as anything else,
So I'll close on this one then, because I don't want to get too much more now. I want to make sure we get it on tape later. Is the ebook coming out this month?
It's called Shut Up and Write, and it's basically sort of like a step-by-step plan for writers who need to find time and focus for their personal projects. And so I basically lay out a step-by-step plan, like pick your place, pick your project, pick your time, pick your whatever. And that's what the chapters are called. So there are 30 chapters, 29 chapters, all sort of telling you to pick something and then stick with it and create create a space for you to do the work that you love.
I love it.
Thank you.
This is awesome. I'm really excited about diving into some of these key aspects of your story. I feel like I think it's going to resonate deeply with a large portion of our audience. So,
thank you. Do you need numbers? Should I look up numbers, or are you just going to keep it?
If we need numbers, so it'll be a narrative style. So I'll have the chance to kind of narrate the whole story in between. And if I feel like we need specific numbers, I'll just reach out and then I'll fill that in rather than you having to, you know, dive in with that or look them up.
Perfect. Perfect. I'm so honored that you picked me.
Oh, absolutely. I think you, you represent a different business model than what the vast majority of people think about when they think of what we do. And your backstory is fascinating too. So I just think it's going to be great.
Thank you.
So what I'll do from here is I will reach back out once I'm done with this round of pre-interviews, and we'll schedule a longer time. Mm-hmm. My ideal situation would be to get 90 minutes, and that's a huge request. So if you can't...
No, that's fine. You can see how much I talk, so...
Okay, all right, great. So I'll ask for 90 minutes, and we'll do it on whatever time is convenient for you.
Perfect. Okay. Wonderful.
Will you pronounce your name for me so that I make sure I get it right?
Yeah, it's Mridu.
Mridu, okay.
Yep, that's perfect. And Cooler.
Cooler, okay.
Yep, that's perfect as well. And Ralph.
Ralph,
so,
okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. All right, well, Mridu, thank you so much.
Thank you, Barrett. Nice talking to you.
You too.
Have a good rest of your day.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Very well. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad.
So do you tend to do a lot of your work in the evenings?
I do, because I have a 4-year-old, so it kind of works around his schedule.
Right.
At the moment, because he's not going full time to school yet. So he goes for 3-4 hours in the morning, and I do a bunch of, you know, good chunk of work then. And then he comes and I spend a bit of time with him. And then I have the afternoons off, and then I work through the evening.
So that's not so bad. So you get a little work period in early in the day and then a little bit more in the evenings.
Yeah, I mean, I like it this way because I get a sort of time off in the day and I get to do both things. So I'm fully available for him. And my husband takes care of him half the day as well, so it's not too bad.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so my goal is to have you off of here in 90 minutes.
Okay.
And basically what I did was I went through my notes from our last conversation and just kind of said, okay, what are the most important parts of Radu's journey and how can we arrange that into kind of a story? Mm-hmm. But I'll go back and edit this and kind of turn it into more of a narrative afterwards. So nothing that, you know, anything that gets screwed up or messed up or any stories that you want excluded, we can always do that later.
Okay, that's fine.
Cool. So I would love to start with you telling me the story of the first journalistic piece that you ever wrote.
Oh, okay. So I started out writing when I was in college. So I was in India and I was 19 years old at the time. I was in my first year of college and I failed my first year of college. So in India, it's not quite like the US system where you get credits. In India, you give exams at the end of the year and you have to pass all the exams. And then if you fail even a single one, they add up. So if you've basically you would have to repeat the year if you fail a certain number of subjects. And I did because I spent most of the first year of college just, you know, hanging out with friends and partying and, you know, as you do. And so I failed my first year and it was engineering. I was studying computer engineering, which I had absolutely zero interest in. And the only reason that I chose to do computer engineering was because it was my ticket abroad. I wanted to travel. I wanted to move abroad. I wanted to do, you know, have adventures. And as a girl in India, that's kind of a dream that not everybody can aspire to. And I thought that the only way I could do this was to have a computer science degree because that would be, you know, my ticket to San Francisco or, you know, London. And but I had no interest. I had zero interest in computers or engineering, and therefore I failed my first year and started writing on the side just because I had always been told by my teachers that I was a good writer. And so, you know, just to pass the time. And also I thought maybe I could do a bit of freelancing on the side. I started writing and my first published piece was an article for a US magazine called College Bound, which no longer exists. And it was on how to survive failure in college.
Oh, interesting. So you use that early experience, kind of failing that first year as the fuel for that first article.
Exactly. I mean, I had, you know, I didn't know anything. I was young. I didn't know much about the world. I was just sort of in college and I thought, what can I write about? And that seemed to be like the perfect experience to share. And so that's kind of how I got my start. And then from there, I basically just started writing about the things I knew about, which was college and computers. I did a lot of writing on computers in the early days. And it just started from there.
So, you know, there was this little phrase in the middle of all of that that I actually think is probably really important for people to understand who will listen to this. And that was for a woman in India. That probably carries a lot of implied context for you that a lot of other people don't understand. So what does that mean to you to have been a woman in India of college age and wanting to explore the world?
So I don't want to generalize here because there are levels of how much freedom a woman in India has. And so I'll tell you that from where I come from and my family background, I think I had always assumed growing up that the path for me was I was going to go straight from my father's house to my husband's house and I would have a job probably, but, you know, only if my in-laws wanted me to, and I would probably live with my in-laws. I mean, that was the kind of path that was set out for me. That was how my mother lived and that was how my grandmother lived, and that's how a lot of my friends live as well. I didn't want that. So I very early on decided that I didn't want to follow that path, and I had to fight to get out of that. And I don't know how relevant that is to this conversation. But it was a big fight and a big kind of rebellion, I suppose.
So I do think that's interesting because you know, I think so much of our personal history ends up informing the work that we do. I won't dig too deep there, but I would.
Well, it did in that I started following, I left my, so again, like I said, you go from your father's house to your husband's house generally. And I left my parents' house to live alone. And that created quite a bit of friction between my family and I at the time. Now we're all fine and happy. And one of the things I did at the time was that I started writing about women's issues and going to rural India and going to small towns and villages and finding inspiration in the women that were changing their own lives. And it seems so... It seems like an obvious thing to do now to me that you would go and find inspiration in other women. But at the time, traveling alone and going to rural India, where I had not spent much time before, it seemed like a very daring and adventurous thing to do. And I was going hunting for stories. But in the end, those were the stories that made me really change the way that I viewed my life and the life of people around me, and gave me like sort of the confidence to say, you know, if there's a woman in rural India who's taking full control or as much control as she can of her life, then I need to be able to do the same. And I did. And I think I found a lot of inspiration in those early stories that I covered.
Where do you think that kind of streak of, I'll use the word rebellion, maybe that's not how you look at it, but that little streak of rebellion that kind of made you want to travel, that made you want to kind of combat that predetermined path, where did that come from, or where did that start, do you think?
I think a lot of people have that, whether in India or women or men and or abroad. Like, you know, I think a lot of us have that. And it's just about there's something that propels you into action usually. You know, like it could be a bad job or it could be a bad relationship. And we see those stories all the time. And I think for me, it was both of those things in a way, that at 19, I realized that if I didn't change the world around me myself, nobody else was going to do it for me. And I think, I don't know how that understanding came to me so young, but I probably saw a lot of my friends going into marriages that ended up not looking like the kind of marriage that I would have wanted, or having, you know, careers that didn't look like the careers that I wanted. And so I figured that if I didn't take a bold step, then I was going to end up doing the same thing. And I think that was the thing that I feared the most, is becoming, just becoming the person who has to ask for permission to do things. And I don't know, there must be something in each of us that sometimes we let die out, and something needs to spark it. And I think for me, it was eventually that I could see all around me proof of what my life was going to look like and what I didn't want it to be.
Hmm. So when you failed that first year of college, you turned to writing.
Yeah.
Had you always been a writer? Like, where did that come from, that was the thing you immediately turned to?
Yeah, I had actually. So when I was five, my parents moved to London. And so we were here, and now I am again in the UK, and we were here for 3.5 years. And when I was in school, I wrote a short story which got made into the school play. And I think that was it. That was when I realized that I could do something like that. And I didn't know that writing could be a profession. I didn't realize that, you know, people wrote for a living. And in India, I knew no writers, and I'd never met an author. And when I was in school, you know, you'd get these assignments of what I did on my summer vacation and things like that. And everybody would write the page that they had to write. And I would write 10-page long assignments and stories, and my teacher would read them out in class. And I'd just go to town with it, and I loved it. And my teachers always told me that I was a good writer. So when I failed college and I thought, what should I do now? It kind of almost seemed like the obvious choice.
So after you wrote that first piece, what did that feel like to have that published somewhere other than, you know, just in your own notebook?
You know, it's really funny, because my first reaction was, oh, this is so easy, I could do this. And I didn't realize that, you know, writing, I mean, I did over a period of time, but I didn't realize that writing and publishing was so hard. And I think it was kind of like the thing you don't know doesn't hold you back. So I didn't know that it was hard to get published. I didn't know that it was hard to get assignments. So what I did initially was just send out pitches and learn as much as I could online. And I just did it. And the other thing I didn't know was that India, being in India or being Indian was supposed to hold me back. And so I didn't know that. And so I never really worried about it. And I just kept sending my work out to the top editors. I got rejections from the New York Times for years. And I just, I didn't know that it was a hindrance. So it wasn't a hindrance. And it was only after I'd been published for maybe a couple of years that I realized that a lot of people find it a challenge to get published initially. Because I found it quite easy. And then there were challenges somewhere in the middle. But because I didn't know, I think I was just uninformed, it never really felt like a struggle.
So after that first year of college and knowing that you had to repeat it, did you go back?
Yeah, I went back and I finished it because in India, again, the thing is that if you don't have a degree, you can't even get a job at McDonald's. So I did have to finish the degree. I could have done a different degree, but I was already there. I thought I'd finish it. So I am now a qualified engineer. Don't let me anywhere near your computer. but I was writing on the side all through the 4 years of college, the 5 years in the end. And by the time I graduated, I was making a full-time living with my writing.
So let's pull out a couple of stories between, well, number one, so you ended up getting a degree. You did go back for computer engineering and you did get the degree in that topic, even though you didn't like it very much.
Yeah.
Which I think we can connect back later. That was probably the skills you ended up using to build your own site at some point.
I don't think so, because what we learned as engineers was a lot of was nothing to do with websites.
Oh, okay, got it.
Yeah, so probably not.
Okay, so tell me, how did you go from, what was the story of going from publishing that first piece to by the time you graduated 4 years later, I'm guessing, to making a full-time living? What did that look like doing that alongside your studies?
So I didn't study a lot. When I did graduate, I graduated barely. So we should be honest about that. I was writing pretty much full-time at the time, and I had a job as well. So I was writing on the side. I had a job and I was a full-time in quotes student. So I never went to college. I just did the exams and I passed. So I never really went to college. I had a full-time job for about a year during that period at a magazine, and I had written for them one freelance piece, and they liked it so much they asked if I'd come interview for a job. So I went in, and this was a computer magazine as well. So I went in, I interviewed for the job, and I got the job. And by the time I left, I was pretty much writing half the magazine. And I realized at the time that I really loved writing and I hated getting up in the morning. So I knew that I wanted flexibility and I wanted, you know, I wanted to work on things that I cared about, and I knew that I could write. And that experience at the magazine also gave me the confidence, to compare myself with other people, to see that the editors were giving me good feedback, to see my work published on such a frequent basis, to speed up the writing. So I learned a lot of valuable skills during that time as well. And that was about 8 months that I was there at that magazine. And I was freelancing on the side, and this is the one thing I had done then and I have continued to do now, which is that I really focus on putting myself out there. I do a lot of marketing. I send out a lot of pitches, and that's what I was doing. I had no work. So if you have no work and you've got a full day to write, what are you supposed to write or do? What I did was I wrote pitches to editors all over the place. So I was sending out 5 pitches a day, which at the time I thought was pretty reasonable. But now, having spoken to other freelancers, I realize not a lot of people do. And I realized over the years as well now that when my work gets low, I'll send out a pitch a day just as a normal thing. And a lot of freelancers struggle with that. And so from there, eventually, many years later, was born my course, my e-course called 30 Days, 30 Queries. But initially, I didn't know that this was such a tough thing, that marketing was tough. I've never found marketing very difficult, because to me, marketing as a writer was not putting myself out there physically. It was just writing an email. And that was something I was good at. I'm good at writing, so I can write an email. And I sent hundreds of them initially, and I had like a 1% response rate, and then it was a 2%, and then 10%, and 50%. So, you know, I just kept sending stuff out there until I broke them down, and also I improved.
So if we go back to that computer magazine, what was the name of that?
Living Digital. Living Digital. It was an Indian. Yeah.
And
this was before, you know, this was before electronics were a part of everyday life. So Living Digital at the time was like this amazing new phenomenon of, you know, gadgets being a part of everyday life. I know it sounds weird now, but back in the day, it was just a computer and you didn't have iPhones and things like this.
Right. And I'm sure, so some of the other writers had to have been professional writers writing at the time for that magazine, right?
Yeah, some were. Some were tech geeks who had, you know, a lot of technical knowledge, but not that much writing experience. Some were recent graduates or college, you know, students like me. I had one experience there, which sort of sealed my fate, so to speak, and I think that might be interesting, which was that there was a woman who had done, there was a college graduate who had done a degree from Cambridge and who'd come to the magazine and she'd been hired in. And I was asked to train her because she knew nothing about computers, but she had a degree from Cambridge in something, I don't know what. And she was being paid like about three times my salary. So I went to my editor, the person who'd hired me, and I said, well, if I'm going to be training her, then shouldn't it be reasonable that my salary should be higher than her or at least equivalent to her? And the editor had sat me down and said, well, she has a degree from Cambridge and you don't, so we're going to pay her more. And I think at the time I sat down and realized that my fate had to be in my own hands if I wanted to succeed, because I didn't want to go to Cambridge and I didn't feel the need to get another degree. I could barely finish the one I had. And I wanted to write and I was a good writer and I was training people. And yet I was not going to be rewarded because I didn't have the things they wanted me to have, which I was never going to get. And I think I realized at that time that I was going to be in control of my destiny and not anybody else. And I think that's kind of been my story all through my life.
Mm-hmm. So you went on to pitch all of these publications. So do you remember some of the publications that you were targeting as you were writing on the side of your degree?
Pretty much anything from the local paper to, the national magazines. I was targeting all the women's magazines. I was targeting mostly US publications at the time. Barrett, can I call you in just 2 minutes? I've suddenly been interrupted.
Sure.
I will get back to you just very, very quickly.
Okay. No worries.
Sorry. Yeah. You were asking about the publications.
Yeah. So, and just trying to get a sense for like who you were targeting at the time and even how you knew how to go about that so early. Did you just kind of figure that out on your own or did you have a mentor at the time or how did you figure that out?
So I went online to find out how to be a freelance writer because I knew absolutely nothing about it. And the only resources that came up were from American writers. And at the time, there were very few Indian writers. Even today, there are very few Indian writers who are sharing details of publications, mostly because publications in India don't pay very well. And so that's where I learned, is from American writers. And then once I was looking through the American publications, it became pretty clear to me that if I wanted to make a living at this, it would be far, far easier to do it writing for publications in the UK and the US. First of all, because the information was so readily available, but also because, you know, $100 translated to Indian rupees at the time for me was equivalent to my salary, mm-hmm. You know. And I mean, we're talking 19-year-old and we're talking, you know, 15 years ago. But so I could see very clearly that if I wanted to make money, that was the way to do it. And also, prestige-wise as well, it just made sense to target the top publications in the US and the UK. And so that's what I did.
So by the time you graduated college with your computer engineering degree, you were already making the equivalent of a full-time living from pitching and landing enough writing gigs.
Yeah.
How did you go, or tell me the story of how you ended up building writerscrossing.com?
So that, so when I went online for the first time, I saw a lot of writers who had their own websites, which is how I was learning about writing. And I thought I should have a website. And I don't know why I thought this, because a lot of writers even today don't have to be convinced to get websites. And I thought, well, I should have a website. I should have a presence. And I just thought, well, I'd have a writing website where I could sort of journal what I was doing as a female writer from India. And none of this was a conscious decision. It was just sort of like, well, let's just do this and let's try this. And I started Writers Crossing as a resource for writers, mostly international, who could follow, you know, what I was doing, and I would share tips and advice, because you'd had so much advice from, you know, people in the West, and there wasn't anybody really writing about freelancing from India. So I thought, you know, I'll do that. And it, initially, it was just like a little journal of what I was doing, and quickly it became sort of how-to articles, because other people started contributing and emailing me. And I think within a year, I had 7,000 people on that list. And so it became a newsletter of sorts rather than a blog or a journal. It was almost like a magazine in, you know, sort of email format. So there were articles in there, and I had an editorial. And I did that for a few years, and it just started off randomly. And I think I was also kind of copying what other people were doing at the time. So I don't think I was completely original. I was kind of using the format that was popular at the time.
And while you were kind of building and then growing that site, you were also continuing to do the freelance writing?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, the freelancing was the big thing for me. And that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to eventually travel. At the time, I still had no idea how I was going to do that. But, you know, I was writing, and that was the core of what I wanted to do. And then the Writer's Crossing was kind of like sharing with people what I was doing and how I was doing it.
Got it. So you were both being a practitioner and a teacher of the practice.
Exactly. And I wasn't the only one teaching. I had a lot of people contributing articles. So they were, you know, they would send me, I had like a sort of, now that you have guest posts, back then it was article submissions.
Right.
And people would send through their article submissions, and I would publish them.
Is there a story of either like an article you wrote or a pitch that you gave, or just some story that was kind of emblematic of that first year after you graduated college, of what it was like to be a young Indian female freelance writer at the time?
I have a few stories for after that, after college, when I finished and started. And I actually have a free case study series that I do, in which I've outlined five of those stories. I could tell you one or two of those if you like.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting ones is how I broke into time, which is, so I was, I forget now. I had wanted to break into time. So for, I mean, everybody wants to break into time. So that's, almost a given. But I think the reason I wanted to break into time, this is a bit embarrassing, is that I had been dating a guy who's a photographer, and we had a really bad breakup, and he'd always wanted to break into time but never had. He'd stolen a couple of my ideas and sold them to the New York Times, and I thought, you know what, I'll show you, I'm going to break into time. And I was 27 at the time, and I said, I'm going to do it by my 28th birthday, and it was about 3 months to my 26th birthday. And so I just started sending pictures to editors. And there was an editor in London who emailed me back and said, listen, I can't assign this because I'm not the person, you haven't got the right person, but your pitch is really good and I like it. I'm going to forward it to a colleague of mine in India. And so he did that. And the colleague in India didn't assign that, but he said, send me more ideas. So for about 2 months, every single day, I would wake up and I would send this person a pitch, an idea, and I would get a no back in the evening. So every morning, I'd send an idea. Every afternoon, I'd get a no back. I kept going, and I kept going, and I kept going, until eventually, there was like this one moment where I said, my birthday is like about a week away and it's not going to happen. And I'm just going to, this last pitch I'm going to send. And I sent it and he assigned it. It got killed eventually. But I think, and one of the things that I did during that period was I kept sending pitches and he kept saying no. And so eventually at some point I said, listen, I'm not getting anywhere with you. Can I just come by your office and we can discuss where I'm going wrong? And this was a bold thing to do because this is time and I don't know this editor and he's been saying no to me all the time. And he said, sure, drop by my office tomorrow. So I went to his office and I sat with him and he told me exactly what he wanted and how I was going to do it. And I came back and I sent him another pitch and he rejected that and another pitch and he rejected that. And that went on for a while again until eventually I got in.
Do you remember how that conversation went in his office? Do you remember the feedback he gave you when you sat down?
Yeah, he didn't give me feedback on my pitches. He showed me what they were publishing. And sometimes a lot of this is not about you. It's about whether your idea fits that publication at that particular time. So a lot of those ideas would have fit earlier or later, but not at that particular time because they're interested in certain subject areas at the time. So he showed me what they were doing, what kind of stories they were publishing. And he basically sat down with me. And I was young, so, and he was, you know, very experienced. So I think he was trying to help me out there. And at the time, I was also planning to move to Africa, and he told me that was a bad idea, and I did it anyway. But he really sort of, I think he told me, I wrote a blog post about this and the five things that the editor taught me, and he basically said, you're trying too hard. And he also said, just look at what the magazine is publishing, and try to do something similar. You don't have to do breaking news. You don't have to come up with investigative stories that nobody else has done. You just need to find something that's interesting. And that's all it is. It doesn't have to be so hard. And I think that's what a lot of new writers and maybe a lot of new business people miss as well, that it doesn't have to be something so unique and so extravagant and nobody's ever done it before. It just has to be a little slice or a little difference that nobody's noticed. It doesn't have to be something completely new. And I think that's the biggest thing I took away from that.
Do you remember the idea that finally got approved or assigned, even though it ended up getting killed?
I don't, actually. I might have a note of it somewhere. No, I'm sorry, I don't.
That's okay. It's just a fun little detail if you did.
I know. I probably have put it somewhere on a blog or something, but right now I just can't remember.
Okay. I'll search around for it on your blog.
I'll probably have it in that post if I do. There's a case studies series that I do that you might find interesting, actually. It's a five-day series in which I tell five stories. The first one is breaking into Time. There's another one breaking into the New York Times. There's one becoming contributing editor at Elle magazine. And then there's one on how one story idea got me $10,000 from one story idea. So I've got a few of those.
I might go through that then before I publish this. That'll be helpful.
Yeah, I think it will.
So if that was kind of representative of that time where you were regularly sending out pitches, your perseverance was amazing, you know, as we look back at it now and compare it to what others do. Yeah. And you started to break through and you started to get some opportunities that came your way. Do you remember the first opportunity you got that allowed you to travel for your writing?
Yes. So I had started traveling around India quite frequently for Elle magazine, which I had started writing for at that point. And if you read the case studies, I've put it all in order, and I think it will really help kind of structure it. But I'll tell you, I had started writing for Elle magazine because I went to do a follow-up on the one-year tsunami when I was – so that would have been 2005, the end of 2005 – I went to do a one-year follow-up on the South Asian tsunami, and I came back from that, and I wrote a whole reported piece for Elle, and she said, no, I don't want a reported piece, I want you. So I basically wrote a piece sharing my experiences having gone and reported this, and it was quite a popular piece, and the editor and I became friends, and she started giving me a lot of regular work. And sorry, what was the question?
The first time you were able to travel for
a piece. The travel. So that was the first time I traveled, and after that, I started doing a lot of traveling around India. And like I'd said at the time, I knew I had always wanted to travel, but I couldn't get visas for abroad. Money was a problem. So I just started traveling around India and going to villages and towns. And then eventually I thought, you know, I really want to go abroad and nobody else is going to make it happen for me. So once again, what I did was I started applying for residencies, fellowships, and any kind of grants that were available to Indians for going abroad. And I applied to, I think I must have applied to at least 36 of them. And eventually there was this one NGO that said, yeah, we'll give you, you know, we'll sponsor your visa. And that was to Ghana. And so I went there to Ghana for, you know, nothing really. They were an NGO. They worked in child rights. And I said I'd write about child rights and they'd help me out. And if I sold anything, I would give them a mention. But when I got there, I realized they didn't know what they were doing. They had no idea. They had no idea about conflict of interest or, you know, how reporting actually works. And they just thought I'd write whatever they wanted me to write. And that wasn't how it works, obviously. So I kind of parted ways with them very quickly. And then I had 2 months in Ghana to do whatever I wanted. And I just traveled by myself and I had a good time. I think that was the first time I found confidence in knowing that I could trust myself and travel and be who I wanted to be. And then 2 months later, I had to return. My visa expired. I spent all my money. And then after that, I applied again. I thought this was such a great strategy because I could just, you know, keep applying to residencies and grants and things, and then I could do reporting and I could do traveling and I could meet people. And I applied I applied as much as I could, and then I got an acceptance from UC Berkeley for their visiting scholar program at the School of Journalism. So I went there for a year, and this was 2008 to 2009. I went there for a year, and when I came back, I was completely changed. I was like a new person when I came back, because what America had done for me was shown me that I was not just an Indian writer. And I think a lot of Indian writers have this problem, and I certainly did, is that I thought any American writer is better than me because they have access, they have opportunities, they have teachers, they have books. And now we have the Kindle and ebooks, but back then there was no way to learn. And anything I could get was just online. And I thought they have access to the whole world, and English is their first and only language sometimes. And, you know, I just didn't think I was in the league. And when I got there and I realized that I could compete and I was good, and I truly believed for the first time that I was good, mostly because people told me and mostly because I was given those opportunities and those teachings. And I think after that, when I came, I broke into everything. I wrote for the New York Times. I wrote for Vogue. I wrote for all the CNN, you know, like a lot of these big publications. And I think the only thing that had changed was the confidence. And I just knew that now I could do it. I think I could have always done it, but I didn't have the confidence. I always saw myself as an Indian writer. And to me, that was a limitation. And once I got out in the world and once I saw what other people were doing and that they were no different from me, I think I realized that I could compete and I could be as good as them. And then I worked to make it happen.
Is there a moment from your months in Ghana that kind of encapsulates your experience there? There a story of your experience there that shares kind of what it was like to be there on the ground?
Yeah. So when I went, you know, I'd never traveled alone. I, you know, had a fairly sheltered childhood. I didn't know what to expect. Didn't know anybody. Was all by myself. And there's a lack of confidence there as well. What happened at the very end? So I had spent 2 months there on my own, sometimes confident, sometimes not. And I at that time had gone through a difficult period in sort of mental health wise as well. And when I was leaving, so the day that I was set to leave. I had my ticket booked. I arrived at the airport and I gave them my, you know, passport, my ticket, and they said, you can't get on this plane because they had overbooked it and I didn't reconfirm my flight, which you're supposed to do, and I didn't know. And they said, you can't get on this flight. And I tried to argue with them. There was this guy at the counter and I tried to argue with him and he wasn't having any of it. And I could see at the side that he was taking people's boarding passes that had money stuffed in them. And then, you know, like I said, if you gave him a bribe, he would let you onto the plane. And I wasn't going to do that. So I just stood there arguing with him for a while, and then he wouldn't let me on. And I just stepped back and kind of started crying. And, you know, like the kind of crying where people look at you kind of uncomfortably. And then I, you know, once I'd finished kind of being upset and nervous and freaked out, I just kind of thought, you know, I sat down, I went back to my seat, I sat down, I watched my plane take off without me. And I realized I realized that I was enough, that I, you know, I could trust myself and I could be myself and I could deal with this situation, and it didn't need anybody to look after me. And I think at that point, I think that was the first time I realized that I could be alone in a country, in a place, in a career, in anything, and I could be self-sufficient. And I remember that moment sitting there and watching my plane take off and realizing that there was nothing I could do, but that somehow I would still manage to get another ticket and get out of the country, and I would do it because you do. And I think that was the first time I realized that I could be self-sufficient, not just personally, but professionally, in every aspect of my life, I could be self-sufficient. And I think that was a really, that was kind of like a moment for me where I realized that nothing could trap me anymore.
That's a great story. And that's got to be, that kind of realization has to be the kind of fuel you need to apply for fellowship after fellowship. And ultimately, you know, probably to end up landing one like you did to go to the U.S.
Yeah.
So was there an experience in the U.S. that where you had a conversation or you published a piece or you got a piece of feedback from a particular person that really kind of helped give you the confidence that you ended up leaving that program with?
You know, I think every day was all of that. I loved my experience in the U.S. because I was at the journalism school in Berkeley and I was surrounded by the most amazing people. There was so much opportunity there. There was so much teaching there. There was, you know, we were a class of visiting scholars all from different parts of the world. And basically we could audit classes. So we weren't taking classes. We were auditing classes. And then every week we met up and we would talk about world events. And because we were all from different countries, we had, there would be a world event and then you'd be getting the perspective from somebody in France and somebody in China and somebody in Thailand. And, you know, it's just all sorts of, you know, people giving you the perspective on the world news from their point of view, from their country's point of view. And that is so valuable because, you know, you see the news and you see it through your perspective, or you see anything and you see it from your one point of view. And to be able to have like 10 different point of views was just amazing to me. And I think that changed my journalism. It changed the way I see the world. I think my entire, I was there for Barack Obama's election. That was an amazing experience. I think the U.S., the whole year, 9 months that I spent there, it was, I came back a changed person because it just gave me so much confidence in the kind of people I'd met, in the kind of teachings I'd had, in the kind of opportunity there was. I could see that there was opportunity. I could see that if you worked hard and we talk about race issues and all of that, but when I was there, I could see that if I worked hard, nothing would hold me back, and nothing did. And all I saw when I was there was just work hard and you will be rewarded. I didn't see, somebody trying to step on you. So I didn't have that experience. I had the experience of everybody's trying to help you. If you ask somebody for coffee, if they have the time, they will go out with you and they will help you. If you go to a lecturer or a teacher and ask them for advice, they will sit down and give it to you. And a lot of people did that for me. And I found that absolutely encouraging. It gave me confidence. It gave me encouragement. It gave me, I think it gave me vision in some ways as well. Because like I said, I'd always seen myself as an Indian writer. And then finally, for the first time, I saw myself as an international writer, as a writer, period.
So prior to that time, you had kind of started to take the entrepreneurial path as well.
Yeah.
In your teaching business, you had published a book or wrote a book.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me the story of writing Knock Their Socks Off and the results from that in 2005.
So I had the website, and I, like I said, within I think about a year, I had about 7,000 subscribers to the newsletter. And I saw that ebooks, at the time they were PDFs, just plain simple PDFs, were kind of really taking off. And I had bought quite a few. And I'd read them, and I thought, you know, I could contribute. I could do something like this. And again, I was very young, and so I never really questioned whether I should or what it means for my career. Or I didn't think about the big picture. I just thought, well, I want to do this, and so I'll do it. And I think in the early days, that's exactly how I approached pretty much everything. Is I thought, oh, I want to do this, and so I just did it. And I thought, I want to write this book because, you know, I've got a whole website about writing, and I think people will find it really helpful. And I really wanted to write it, so I did. And I think I wrote it within the month. And then because I'd worked at a magazine, I knew a designer. I asked him if he'd design the cover, and he did. And then we had a book. It was PDF, so it wasn't really even hard to sort of make it, you know. And basically, I did what I've done so far every time that I don't know how to do something is I've looked at how other people have done it, how they, you know, did their table of contents, how they did everything, and then I've kind of learned from that and seen what I like best, and then taken inspiration from it, and then created something of my own. And I did that with that book, and then I put it up through PayPal, I think, and then yeah, I just put it up there. And because I had 7,000 people, once I started telling people about it, they bought, and within the year, now I don't have the numbers for how many copies it sold, but I know that I'd made $10,000 within the first year. And then after that is when I started getting really serious about journalism, which is to say that I wanted to travel, and I didn't want the business holding me back, which is that I didn't want to be spending, you know, every week sending out a newsletter and updating the website. And so that's the point at which I kind of started the process of shutting down both the website and then taking the book off as well, because it was sold only through my website. It wasn't sold through any other platform.
Which is a really fascinating move that will, I'm sure some people will hear that and they'll be so confused, but
yeah.
What I get from that was this was a time when you were focused on being a journalist and that was your priority. So tell me how you came to that decision to ultimately delete the email list and shut the website down.
Yeah, I've thought about this, you know, since we talked last time as well, because it seems like such a random decision. And it, in some ways it was, because it was just one fine day. I said, I don't want to do this. And I clicked the delete button and it was gone. And I had no regrets, honestly, at least not until last year. Like when I started building another list, I was like, oh my God, if only I'd had 7,000. But I didn't have any regrets about that because, you know, first of all, it's easy to say, sorry, I'm just, one thing. Right. It's easy to say that, you know, build a business, passive income, that sort of stuff. But actually, when you're in the beginning stages of building a business, even if it's an online business, there's a lot to do. And there's consistency that you have to maintain, because otherwise people won't trust you. So I was sending out a weekly newsletter with articles and an editorial and, you know, market listings and things like that, because it was a mini magazine, like I said. And, you know, all that takes time. And then I was updating the website and I was looking at submissions. And what I thought was happening was that I was spending more time teaching other people how to write than I was writing. And I didn't like that. And I thought that has to change. I think the only thing I would do differently there is that I would keep the newsletter and I would make it personal. I could send out a personal update or something. But at the time, I thought, I don't want to be running a business. I want to be a writer. And so and I wanted to travel. I couldn't have that holding me back. And so I just went ahead and did it. And I think, you know, I know it sounds really crazy, but it was so freeing. Because for the first time, because the moment I became a writer, I'd started a website as well, even though it had initially just been very personal. But there was that responsibility of a website from the very beginning. And then when I shut it down, I shut down the website, I shut down the newsletter. For the first time, I was just a writer. And it was so freeing because I could wake up in the morning and all I had to do was write. And all I had to do was think about what I was going to pitch next and what story I was going to write next. And for a while, that was really not only freeing, but it was also really, I think, smart in that I was able to focus on the thing that I wanted to do with my full attention and then just do it rather than thinking about, oh, there's this other thing I need to do and the other thing and the other thing and the other thing. I was just doing one thing. I was writing and I was trying to break into publications and my goals were clear and I was just focused on them.
And that would lead you then to going to Africa and to Berkeley and all of that after that, right?
Exactly. And I did have a personal blog, which I would update every now and again. So a lot of readers stuck with me through that. But it was very personal. It was like, well, tomorrow I'm going to Berkeley and tomorrow, right, this is what I'm doing. You know, it was very, very personal. And every now and again, I'd share writing advice as well. But it wasn't like it wasn't a website or anything concrete.
And what's so interesting about all of this is that it ends up paying off, right? Now we know this. At the time, there was no way to know it. But in 2010, you won two big awards. Yeah. Before we get to the awards, I want to know what the experience of researching and then writing the story on waste pickers in India was like. Tell me that story of researching it and then writing it.
So that is the waste picker story is, to this day, my favorite story, and I could still go back and keep digging on that one. It was so interesting to me. I didn't find that story. The editor emailed me. There was an editor at Scrap Magazine who emailed me and said, here's the story we'd like you to do if you're available. And she'd found my website. And at the time, I was going to the US, to Berkeley. And I told her that I'd love to, but I'm leaving in a month and I'm really sorry. And so I left and, you know, went on with my life. And a year later, I came back and I was looking for work. And I was, like I said, I was more confident. And I was, you know, I'd come back and I knew what I was doing and I was dedicated and I needed work. So I sent out pitches to editors who had once been in touch, including the Scrap editor. And I said to her, you know, if you have any work, let me know. And she said, you know what, that original assignment is still available if you want it. And I said, yeah, sure. So she sent it to me, and I don't exactly now remember what the assignment was. It wasn't what I ended up writing, because when I went to research it, I found a completely, not a completely different story, but a fairly different story to what the brief had been. And basically, I went to, so the waste pickers in India are people who pick through trash for a living. And basically what they do is they'll pick out bits of plastic and metal and they will sell that to wholesalers who will then sell it to, you know, further on. And like it's kind of like recycling happens here, but at the very bottom is a layer of people who do it manually. So you know how in the West you separate it yourself. In India, people still put all their rubbish in one bag. And so when that rubbish is all collected together, somebody, these waste pickers, will look through all of it. So and this includes food waste, this includes plastic wrappers, this includes everything, and then fish out the tiny bits of plastic and metal. And as you can imagine, there are health issues to this. There are human rights issues to this. There's a whole bunch of environmental issues to this. The waste pickers are helping the environment because of the recycling that they're doing, but they're getting no money. They're getting no credit. And they're, you know, they're suffering so much health-wise. So I followed some of these waste pickers through their day. And they're also at the lowest level of society. So they're not treated very well most times as well. So I was following them through the process of starting their day at 5 a.m., picking through trash, through neighborhoods, then going to the landfills and then picking through there. So there are some people who work through the landfills and some people who work at the and in the homes in the neighborhoods, from people's homes getting the trash. And I was really moved by a lot of what I saw, and there were so many issues to cover as well. I mean, there was just not one story there. There's so many stories there. And so I ended up writing that story for the scrap editor. And then I ended up writing about 10 more after that, because, like I said, there's a human rights issue, there's the health issue, there's the environment issue, there's so many issues. And at the time, the Commonwealth Games were happening in Delhi. So a lot of what the government was trying to do is make them invisible, is that, you know, pretend they didn't exist. Some of them were being sent out of the city. They were being put on trains out of the city so that, you know, when the sports people came, they wouldn't see the dirty waste pickers. And I found, you know, like most people, I found that very moving. And then to have spent time with them and got to know them, I wrote stories about them, and I wrote several stories about them, and they became pretty popular stories. They became, you know, people appreciated those stories, and for me, they were my favorite stories that I've ever done.
At the time you were writing them, did they feel different? Did they have a feel of, oh, this is important, this is, you know, a big story that I'm working on here?
Not really. I've done quite a bit of work on, you know, human rights and that kind of story, and you can never tell what is going to take with people sometimes, because I've covered a lot of, you know, there's one particular story that I remember that I really was moved by as well, was a clinic started by a woman and her husband, who both were HIV positive, and they started this sort of matrimonial service for people who have HIV. And now in the West, this is sort of, you know, not that big a deal, but in India it was, because some of the, like, one of the women I interviewed there, she found out that her husband had been HIV on his funeral pyre, and, you know, he died, and that's the point at which her in-laws said, oh, he had HIV and you might too. And then she went, got tested, and turns out she was positive as well. And so in India, where it's such a, in not in the cities, but in some of the rural areas where it is such a taboo, to then have a clinic like that was quite something. It was bold and it was brave. And I thought that was a really interesting story, and I did get some feedback. There are so many of those stories that I did, and some of them take, and some of them just, you know, get no feedback at all, and that's fine. But I think at the time of writing, I kind of can never tell when something's gonna, you know, really create an impact, and when something's just gonna be a quiet one.
So it's not all that different from pitching stories or from starting a business. You know, you never know how people will react to something necessarily. But you can get better at it nonetheless. And you had
good stories do sell. Good ideas do sell. Good stories do sell. Good businesses do take off. But sometimes some stories take off that you can't anticipate. And sometimes they take off in different ways. Like, there are some stories that will sell to bigger publications for more money. And there are some stories that will get a lot of reads and shares. And, you know, there are different ways in which some stories end up. And I think it's hard to say how, you know, each will do, especially on these kind of human rights sort of things where, you know, at the moment it seems like we're seeing them all the time. And so sometimes people, like, you know, there's an editor who used to say to me, like, if it's a slow day, they just do, you know, puppies. Because people are always kind of taken with that story for some reason. But it makes sense, you know, if you think about it, it makes sense, because it's like cute puppies. But there are other cute things in the world that don't take, you know. So you can never tell.
So this one in particular, though, you ended up winning two big awards for.
Yeah.
Do you remember the moment you found out that you were going to win an award for a piece of your work?
The first one came, my editor just emailed and she said, oh, I'd entered this into the award. So the first one was a silver award, so it was a second prize from a U.S. trade organization. And my editor had entered it. I had no idea she'd entered it. She emailed me and she said, "You won the second prize," and I was quite happy about that. And so that was that. The second one, which was the Development Journalist of the Year award, that was they had told me that I was the I was among the finalists, and they'd invited me to Tokyo for the ceremony. And we were in India at the time, and we had planned to go. And then my husband, my new husband at the time, had realized that, you know, he needed to go back to the UK to renew his visa. And so now my choice was go to the UK with my new husband, meet my in-laws. You know, I'd met them already, but, you know, the first time going to the UK with my husband, or go to Tokyo for the award. And I thought, and I honestly thought, there's no way I'm going to win, so I'm just going to go to the UK. And so we went to the UK, and I, you know, while we were in the UK, I found out that I actually won the thing.
What did that feel like?
Oh, it was great. I loved it. I mean, it didn't matter that we didn't get to go, but just the fact that I'd, you know, just the fact that I'd won, I had, like I said, I just totally thought I was not going to win. I was like, you know, there's no way I'm winning. So I didn't even bother going to Tokyo because there's no way I was going to win. And so when they told me that I had, it was just kind of amazed and shocked and pleased and yeah, all of those things.
So the next year you ended up getting pregnant, and that kind of changed your perspective on being able to travel and be in certain kinds of situations doing your work.
Yeah.
So just tell me that story about becoming pregnant and how that changed your thinking about the nature of your work at the time.
So at the time I was really into this waste picker story. I was doing fair amount of travel. I was interested in, you know, human rights. And when I got pregnant, I think I became very conscious of the fact that, first of all, as I'm pregnant, I don't want to be in situations that can be harmful for my child. And I had had instances where, you know, small instances where that had happened. And so I was extra cautious because of that, because, you know, you get very protective when you're pregnant. And then once my son was born, I knew that I wanted to spend a lot of time with him, and I didn't want to be off traveling. And my husband had a job, and he, you know, it just felt like it was time to change course a little bit. And I didn't want to be in dangerous situations myself. I didn't want to carry him around and take him into certain situations with me, which was always an option that I could, you know, put him on my back and go to villages and do interviews there. And I'd always thought I would do that, actually. That was my plan, was to do that. And when it came time to do it, I just couldn't. And I realized that I was going to have to make a shift in what I was doing, because I was quite happy being home with him. It didn't feel like a big sacrifice to me, because I felt like, you know, I get to be at home and write and be with my son. And I didn't necessarily feel the need to travel as much as I had when I was younger. First of all, because I'd done some of it. And also because, you know, there was something better at home. And so I started thinking about books at that time. That's when I seriously started thinking, because I had always wanted to write books. I'd always wanted to be a novelist. I'd always wanted to sort of, you know, have a shelf full of books. And that's the time when I thought, you know, if I'm going to change course, maybe that's the thing to start doing.
And so you had your personal site where you had just kind of been sharing personal updates, not all that different from a journal.
Yeah.
And you decided to relaunch your email list about that time, right?
Yeah. That was a sleep deprived decision, because it was just, I woke up one morning and I thought, you know, if I'm going to become a writer, if I'm going to be an author, then I'm going to need to promote my books. And at this point, I had no idea for a book. And I was just thinking, if I'm going to be an author, hypothetical thing in the future, then I'm going to need to sell my books. And in order to sell my books, I'm going to need an email list. And in order to get an email list, I better get started now, because it's going to take years to build it. And by the time I get there, I'd, you know, want to have numbers and blah, blah, blah. And so one thing led to another, and suddenly I had an email list. And And it started off being a monthly thing that I, for a couple of months, I think I sent it once a month. And I thought, do it or, you know, do it properly or don't do it. So then I went to weekly. And this time I kept it simple. And so even to this day, I send a weekly newsletter. It's a personal sort of essay or editorial, whatever you'd like to call it, about the writing life, personal struggles that I know other people can learn from or see themselves in. And so it's meant to be part inspirational, part reflecting the truth of the writing life. And partly just asking questions of my readers. Is this what you want to do? Why are you not doing it? Is this your challenge? You know, things like that. And I get a good response to that because people really identify with, you know, the challenges that I have, because a lot of people have similar challenges.
And so here you are 6 years later after shutting down your last email list, and kind of coming all the way back around full circle.
Yeah.
Did you continue freelance writing at the time?
I did, and I still do to this day, because I feel like if I'm going to talk about being a writer, freelance writer, any kind of writer, then and I'm not saying everybody has to do this, but for me it was important that I continue doing it just to stay current, to know what's going on in the world. It's such a quickly shifting, moving industry at the moment. If you're not actually doing it, then the advice you're giving yesterday could be the wrong advice. Could be the wrong advice today. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that. So, and partly also financial, partly because I like it. I think I've come to the, you know, I used to have this idea of who do I want to be, and it had to be this one thing. So I have to choose. I have to be a business person, or I have to be a novelist, or I have to be a freelancer. And now I've kind of come to the conclusion that I can be all of those things. I don't have to pick one. And so right now, I just call myself a writer because I have a business and a lot of it requires writing. I am writing a novel. I am, you know, I do freelancing. I do content marketing. So there's so many things that I do. And the only common thing between all of them is that it's all related to writing, which is the only thing I've ever wanted to do, writing. And everything I have done, whether that's the business or books or anything else, is all surrounding that. And that kind of also frees you up to, you know, if you have like a central core that you know that's what it is, and anything else around it is fine. You don't have to pick. You can do all of those things. And you can do all of those things in different times. It doesn't mean that if I've written a novel today, then I have to keep writing them for the next 100 years. I could write one today and never write another one again if I didn't want to. I can stop freelancing and start again. I can, you know, have the business running, ticking over for a while, and then just put all my resources into it, which is exactly what I end up doing. Every now and again, there's always going to be one project that takes a massive chunk of time, and everything else is sort of still going. It's still ongoing. But there's always one big thing that's going on at the moment. But now I don't shut down things.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Which is maybe a lesson learned. So yeah. In a couple years after you restarted your email list in January 2014, you ended up making a move towards turning that into a business. What was that first course you launched, and where did it come from?
The course was called 30 Days, 30 Queries, and I had started a challenge on my blog because a lot of my readers seem to struggle with marketing, and a lot of writers in general struggle with marketing because I think it's I think it's two different sides of your brain, the artist and the business person. And I've been really fortunate in that I have a strength as both. I feel like I'm a strong business person. I'm really good at negotiating. I'm really good at like talking, you know, standing up for myself and all of that stuff. And I'm good at marketing. I'm also, I feel, a good writer. So I've got both those skills. And sometimes one takes precedence over the other. But I find that a lot of writers see themselves as artists and not necessarily as business people. And so when it comes time to do the business, they shut down, or they're not very confident, or they worry that they're not doing it right. So in terms of negotiating, for instance, they won't push it hard. Or in terms of marketing, they'll give up very easily. And so on my blog, I always said that you should make one marketing effort a day. And I define that as anything. It could be, you know, emailing with an editor. It could be following an editor on Twitter or whatever. One marketing effort a day. And pitching to me has always been the marketing effort that has worked really well. Just sending a pitch, sending an idea to an editor. I mean, to me, that seems like the easiest way to do it. And I know a lot of people struggle with it, but personally, I always found it the easiest way. Networking to me was the hard bit because I'm a bit of a hermit. I'd rather be in my cave. And so emailing editors ideas and getting assignments, that to me was like, wow, you know, that's the easiest thing in the world. And when I realized that other people did not have that same comfort level with it, I challenged my readers to send one pitch a day. And a lot of them started, you know, we started talking about it on my blog, on Twitter, and, you know, a lot of them got enthusiastic about it. But halfway through, I was the only one who was continuing. People started falling off. And I realized that, you know, there was something there, that people wanted to do it and couldn't. And so I thought, well, maybe I could show them. And that's how I started. So I launched the course before I'd ever written a word. And I said, would you guys be interested in a 30 days, 30 queries course? And we'll do one lesson a day. I'll send it over email and let's see how it goes. And I thought, you know, a few people would sign up and that'd be great and I'll do it. And 50 people signed up for that first session. And I was absolutely amazed. And so then we went on with it. And now it's one of our better selling courses.
So how did you go from, you know, that was in January 2014. And then over a year later, you ended up launching your second course. Why so long of a gap in between the first and the second?
Partly because we were moving. So when I launched that first course, we were in India. And then 6 months later, we moved to London, and there's a lot of upheaval during that period, and then just settling in. And then I had to go back to India to get a proper visa. And so there was a lot of moving around in which I couldn't really focus that much on stuff that was going on at work. But there was the other thing, which is that in August that year, so in January, I launched the 30 days, 30 queries course. And in August, I started the International Freelancer because I realized I have a course, I have a newsletter. God, I need a website. So the course came, the newsletter came first, then the course, and then the website. And then I was just kind of getting the website to a point where, you know, it had all the necessary sort of sign up forms and the blog posts and everything and the design. And I think that took some, you know, like I just thought, let's put some effort into this. And I did that for a while. And until then, I hadn't actually had an idea for a course. I hadn't thought of a second course. And then again, this came through my readers, which was that a lot of people were writing to me and saying, journalism is just not paying well anymore. And how are you making your money? And at the time, I was doing quite a bit of content marketing. And that was the way I was making an income. And so I said, well, this is how I'm doing it. And a lot of people were asking me, what is content marketing? How do you do it? How do you get work? And I was getting, at this point, you know, there was kind of like a gold rush in content marketing as well, which is where there was a point where I was making $400 an hour. And that's not happening as much anymore, but there is still good money to be made. And a lot of people were asking me, well, who are your clients? How are you doing it? How are you approaching them? And I went back and looked at my work history and some of my journals and the things, and I realized that there had been a period of a year where I had done a lot of learning, sending out pitches this way, that way, and then something had clicked and I'd been able to then get work immediately in that space because I think there's a threshold that you cross when you've learned a new skill, and, you know, that it takes time to kind of become, you know, it takes time to get ingrained in your brain, I suppose. And then you, once you know the stuff instinctively, it starts sort of making sense and then it starts working. And that's what happened. And then I thought, well, now I understand it and now I can explain it. And so I launched the Content Marketing for Journalists course. And then I started kind of teaching journalists how to, you know, sort of transition into content marketing.
Right, which was kind of like a way of helping people shift their writing skills from storytelling, which could be used in content marketing, but more business focused, basically, and selling to a different kind of client.
You know, actually, storytelling is the key there, because in content marketing, a lot of firms and big businesses are hiring journalists specifically because journalists know how to tell stories.
Right.
And so the demand for journalists in content marketing is huge. And a lot of journalists don't know this. There's also this thing of, if you cross from journalism into content marketing, you have to be aware that there's no going back, because now you've jumped from being, you know, completely objective to now working with a business.
Right.
And so, you know, you have to, and a lot of people specialize in a certain space. So if you're a business journalist and then you start working for businesses, then you kind of lose that. And you have to be aware of that. But so many people were coming to me and saying, well, I cannot be a writer anymore, because if I'm not making money, then it doesn't matter whether I'm a journalist or whatever. I won't be able to do any of it, because there's no money. I'm not getting money. I'm not getting paid. And so a lot of my readers and I personally have made the shift to content marketing, and I'm quite happy with that, because I can still do journalism in spaces that are away from my content marketing specialties, but I don't, and this has to be a conscious choice, but I don't call myself a journalist exclusively anymore. I'm quite happy to say that I do all kinds of writing,
mm-hmm.
but that is a choice that you have to make, and I think a lot of people are happy to make it now.
And so that second course on content marketing for journalists was the biggest success you had seen to that point. You made $10,000 in a matter of days, as opposed to over the course of a year, like you had with your first ever book.
Yeah.
So that kind of led to a little more progress quickly, and you ended up launching another course 6 months later or so in 2015. What was that one, and where did that come from?
So that one's called Making Money with Websites. And by this time, the International Freelancer was a business, and it was making money, and it was making, you know, a good amount, you know, it's a proper income. And a lot of writers, again, my audience is completely writers. They might be novelists, they might be, you know, freelancers, but they're mostly writers. And all they want to do is write. They're not really concerned with all the frills and fancies of the business necessarily. They're not entrepreneurs. They don't want to be, you know, they don't want a six-figure business. They want to write. And a lot of them were asking me, well, is it possible to, you know, write about, say, pets and make money? Or is it possible to write about this particular, you know, niche and make money? And I was telling them, yes and no. I mean, it depends on what the niche is. Like pets, it's a very popular topic online. Like, you know, like I said, dogs, puppies. But in terms of selling to publications, it can be really hard sell. First of all, because there aren't that many publications focused exclusively on these topics, and the ones that aren't exactly, you know, so high paying that you'll be able to pay all your monthly bills from two articles. So the way I found that helpful was to create websites about niche topics. And I know other people have done it. And of course, so do you. And that was one way to do it. The reason I thought that I needed to have a different course and not just send them to all the other entrepreneurial websites was that a lot of the entrepreneurial websites and a lot of the courses are geared towards people who want to be entrepreneurs, who want to start a business. I wanted to focus on the people who want to write. So what I teach is how to create a very, very content-focused business, and then to use the platform you've created, like, say, the blog, and use that audience to then launch books or to get speaking engagements or to create other kinds of content from that audience that you've built. So I teach them how to build the audience and then to leverage that audience. And so that's not necessarily just the website and the business, but using that website and that business to be able to write the things that you want to write about. So I think that was the difference there. And yeah, I think a lot of people have found that quite helpful as well. And I personally found that really helpful, because as I was doing the research for that course and I was writing that course, and this is the first time I've created a course on something that I'm not 100% successful at. And I found that quite interesting, because I learned so much as I was doing that, and I've implemented those things in my business now and grown that further as well.
Hmm. So at what point did you transition from your personal site to the International Freelancer brand during all of this?
That was August 2014.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was just after we'd moved to London, and again, it was an impulse decision. My decisions are always impulse decisions. I never sit down and say, should I do this or shouldn't I do this? I just go, I think I should do this, and then I just do it.
Mm-hmm. So that was part of that whole kind of business setup period that you talked about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure I think about it over a period of time. You notice things, and then one day the impulse decision happens. But, you know, over a period of time, I was noticing that people were, you know, the websites that really worked were websites that had a structure to them, that had brand recognition to them, that had, you know, some sort of purpose to them. And my website was not that, because my website was a personal portfolio and I wanted to keep it that way as well. And there was the other thing, is that it was getting a bit muddied, because if you came to my personal website, you didn't know what to expect. If you were an editor, you'd see my clips and then you'd also see this blog for writers and you'd be a bit confused. And if you were a writer, you'd come and see all my clips and you'd be like, well, there's nothing here for me. So I thought I was kind of not serving any purpose. And by dividing them, then I could have, you know, the website that caters to writers and then the website that just caters to my own personal work, if anybody's interested. And I think that's a really good decision that I made there, because now on my personal website, I can showcase my books or I can showcase my novels or I can just talk about my personal life or I can do whatever. Whereas the International Freelancer is a brand in itself. And when people come to it, they know what to expect.
Right. So here we are now. We've kind of brought ourselves up to present day, March 2016. What's happening in your business today? What's happening in the International Freelancer and your freelancing work today?
So my goal for the International Freelancer now is to automate it as much as I can. I kind of go through these. I always stop every now and every few months. I stop and ask what the purpose is for everything I'm doing. And it's not a very conscious decision. It's just something I think all of us do. But then I sit with the results quite frequently, which is that I just ask myself, what do I want to do? What is the next right move on this project? And for the International Freelancer, there was a point when I thought I really want to hit six figures with it. And I think I could, if I gave it all the push that I have in me, if I put all my energy into that, I think I could. And then I realized that that probably wasn't the right move for me, because what I really wanted to do at this point, and this will obviously change, but right now what I want to do is work on a novel. And so I'm trying to put my energy onto that while still keeping everything going. So the International Freelancer used to have a setup where all the courses were launched, and then I would have a big launch, and then you could sign up, and then the signups would close. And for two reasons, I found that limiting for me personally, because, you know, I have to do a launch every few months for every single course. And that was just getting to a point where people had heard about it. They don't need to be told about it all the time. And the other thing is that, you know, a lot of my students and I tell them that, you know, a lot of my readers, I tell them that you shouldn't wait until the new year to start something. You shouldn't wait until next month to start a new project. If you want to do it, start now, start today. It's 7:15 on, you know, 21st of March. Doesn't matter. You don't have to wait for the new year. You don't have to wait for the new month or the new week. You don't have to wait for Monday. Just do it now. And I realized with my courses, they couldn't do it now. And I wanted to make that available. So I've kind of gone the teachable route now, which is that I've just basically made them on demand. And I haven't got all of them set up yet. But basically the idea is that if you want to take the course, it's there whenever you want to take it, on your own, at your own time, at your own pace. And I want to give you the freedom and the flexibility that I want for myself. I think that's the idea. So I've done that. And with the International Freelancer, the next plan is to... So the International Freelancer, I think, has always been intended as a site for mid-career journalists and not necessarily beginner journalists. And I haven't always achieved that. And I think my goal for that is to talk more about, you know, issues that are of concern to mid-career journalists, which is regular income and regular assignments and how to deal with the burnout that happens, you know, over a period of time. and not necessarily just the beginning stuff like marketing. So I still have a way to go with that, but that's the next plan for that. And also I would automate it. I would like to automate it for personal reasons as well, just to free up a bit more of my time while I focus on other things. Freelancing continues. I do a lot of freelancing at the moment because that's what pays. That's what keeps me in business, really, in terms of, a large chunk of my income comes from freelancing. And then the third big thing I'm doing is the novel, which I hope will at some point pay off. But for now, it's just fun.
So when you think back to that, 19-year-old girl writing her first freelance assignment after failing her freshman year of college, and you compare that to the person you've become, how is the Meridu of today different from that young girl starting out in her journalism career?
More confident, for sure. Definitely more at ease with herself. I think I'm more willing to try things and fail because my whole idea of who I am is not wrapped up in one assignment or one, thing. I've learned that I am a bigger whole person than just one assignment or just my career or just one thing. I think with most people, over a period of time, you grow into who you are supposed to be. And I think I've done that to some certain extent, and I hope I'll continue doing that. But when I was 19, I could not have imagined writing for the publications that I've written for. I could not have imagined having found, a really great guy. I could not have imagined the life I do. I always wanted to live in London, could not have imagined that I would make it to the UK. So I think I exceeded some of my expectations in that regard is because I had so little confidence and so little expectation. I always knew that I wanted to do things. I didn't always believe that I was capable. And I think the difference between that 15 years is that I know now that I am capable and that everybody is capable. It's not that you need something special. It's just that you need to keep pushing and you need to keep believing that it will happen if you do, that you need to keep persisting. I think it's all of it. All of life is a numbers game. The more of yourself you put out there, the more will come back to you. And I think I really truly believe that now is that if you just keep doing the work, the results will happen. They might not happen tomorrow. They might not happen in a week. But eventually, if you add it up over a period of 10, 20 years, you can see the difference.
And how have the stories you've gotten to tell over those 15 years, how have those changed your perspective on the world or changed your outlook on life?
In small and subtle ways, every story has made an impact, I think, and it has to, because otherwise it's not a story that you can tell well if it hasn't impacted you. Because I think of one of the stories that that really had a big impact on my writing life in particular was a story of these blind theater actors that I met, that I did a profile on, and they were not successful by any financial measure. They were poor, in India they were poor, and they were people who sold like incense streets on the incense sticks on the street, or people who were domestic workers, and in the evening and they were all blind, and they would all come together in the evening and they would go to theater class, which was like a little hut somewhere. And then they would perform on the street or in small villages. They got paid pretty much nothing, but they had that group. And I remember interviewing one of the guys, and he, his parents used to say to him, like when he would leave for the theater class, they'd say to him, well, who do you think you are? Who do you think you're going to become? Do you think you're going to be Amitabh Bachchan? And Amitabh Bachchan is like a huge superstar in India. Like, do you think you're going to be Amitabh Bachchan? Who do you think you are? And he would, some days it would defeat him and he would not go. But most days he would just say whatever, and then he would still go. He would go to his class and he would find his community and he would perform. And I compared that to writing in that when I asked him why they continued going there even though they knew it was not going to bring any reward. And that's a question that was important for me to ask, is if you know that there is no reward at the end of this, why would you continue doing this? And he said to me, it's not some reward that's going to come. This is the reward. Doing the acting is the reward. And for me, I thought that's such a fantastic way of looking at it. And I have continued to. And I know it sounds really impractical at times, but the writing is the reward. It has to be the reward because there is no guarantee of what comes at the end. So you have to enjoy what you're doing. If you hate what you're doing in the hopes that there will be some, you know, fantastic reward in the future, well, if there isn't, then is your life wasted? And I don't want my life to be wasted. And so I want to know that what I'm doing today, even if nothing comes of it, I have enjoyed doing, then that makes it worth it to me. And I think that's the way I now look at my business, and that's the way I look at my writing, and that's the way I look at everything. And that's not to say that I don't need to pay bills, because I do. So I do have to do some of the work that's going to pay the bills. But whenever I can, I still want to do the stuff that I enjoy, because otherwise, what's the point? Mm.
So as kind of parting words, if you were, if you were sitting down over a coffee with maybe a recent college graduate, or maybe just someone that hopes to build a business as a writer and to become a freelance writer that can support themselves, and they're just starting out, what advice would you share with them?
Just practice. Just keep doing it. Persistence and practice. I think those are the two things that you have to do. You have to keep doing the stuff, and then you have to keep sending it out. Because if you keep writing, you will get better. And if you just keep writing and writing and writing, you will find that not only, well, you'll become better, but you'll also become more confident, and you'll also learn new things. But if you keep writing and not sending it out, if nobody ever gets to see it, then what's the point? You're not doing the next step, which is also important, which is to send it out, which is to get the rejections, which is to get the feedback, which is to get the acceptances eventually. And so I think both of those things, and you have to not give up, because everybody gets rejections. And as a writer, you're going to get so many rejections. And if you let the rejections defeat you, then you've kind of made a mistake there. Because the rejections are almost a guarantee in this business and any business. The rejections are a guarantee. The acceptances are not. So the rejections cannot be the reason you give up. And so just, yeah, practice and persistence. You just have to believe in yourself. You have to believe that you will get there even when you don't completely believe in yourself at the moment. Like you know that you're not quite the standard that you would like to be. We all have great taste, which is, you know, there's this Ira Glass thing, which I'm sure you've heard, is that when you start out as a writer, your taste is so much better than your capability. And when you try to match the two, they don't match. So you look at your work and you think, this is crap. And it will be, but if you keep doing it, you'll get better.
It's a great, great note to end on.
Sorry, I lost my voice there.
That's good. Thank you so much. We almost ended on time, just a couple minutes over.
Are we? It says, oh yeah, we did. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Looking at the new. Yeah. That's fine. At 11 o'clock at night, I have all the time in the world.
Good. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you being so generous, and I think people are going to love your story.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
I think.
Do you know when this is going to come out?
I'm not sure. So this is a 12 episode season. You are the fifth full interview I have recorded. So I'm almost halfway done with recording. And I still have to go through and script and record all of the narrative for all of the episodes. So it'll probably be middle or end of April before the first episode goes out. And I'm not sure exactly when yours will fall
into
sequence.
Not a problem. Gives me more time to get the website up in shape.
There you go. So I will I'll send you a copy of what we'll be publishing live before it goes out. And you can give that a listen ahead of time.
Thank you. Thanks. That's really nice of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll follow up. If there's any gaps or anything, I may follow up a little bit just to get some clarification and make sure I don't mischaracterize anything. But
that's
in general,
Thank you.
Should be all good.
Cool. Thank you so much, Barrett. And I'm really honored that you chose me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's an inspiring story, and I'm sure you've been told that before, but it's unique. and you add a lot of color to what otherwise can be a pretty bleak landscape of business stories about overnight success and all of this crap that we know exists out there. And I think your story battles that with a more positive outlook on it. So I love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'll let you get back to finishing up your work for the evening.
Thank you, Barrett. And have a good rest of your day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.